Aura, that Rabbi Aaron Kotler makes in reference to last week's parsha and in reference to this week's parsha. He says if you look at last week's parsha, if you look at Parshas Bamidbar, and you look at this week's parsha, you look at Parshas Nasai, and the tremendous elaboration that there is in the Torah, the detail that the Torah goes into in connection with the traveling and the camping of Klal Yisrael, right? How they traveled and how they stopped and established the camp. And if you look at the way in which the Torah describes in infinite detail the positioning of the different tribes around the Degolim, around the Mishkan, and then you look at this week's parasha and the tremendous detail that the Torah goes into in reference to how the Mishkan was carried when they traveled from place to place and who carried what and who was allowed to carry what and who wasn't allowed to carry, v'chule, 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 seems to be an inordinate, it seems to be out of whack. In other words, why is the Torah spending so much effort and so much time telling us about these things which seem to be very, very technical and don't seem to fit into the general pattern of the Torah telling us things to teach us something? And it's very nice to know that when Klal Yisrael camped, so this tribe was here, that tribe was there, this tribe was located in this place, that tribe was located in that place. It's very nice to know that when the Mishkan was dismantled and it had to be carried from one place to another, that this family carried this and these people carried that and that one carried this and this one wasn't allowed to carry this but was allowed to carry that. But what's it there to teach us? So Rav Aaron expands on the theme that what the Torah is trying to teach us is that when it comes to Avodas Hashem, when it comes to anything to do with anything which is spiritual, there has to be a order. If you're disordered, you don't get anywhere. In other words, anything to do with anything which is spiritual revolves around a Seder. That's the route, the route that he takes. That's the direction that he goes. And I want to go in a slightly different direction. And perhaps one could suggest that the inyan of the Degolim and the fixing of a location for the where each shevet was located and the infinite detail that the Torah goes into about carrying the Mishkan and carrying the kelim of the Mishkan, who's allowed to, who's not allowed to, is coming to teach us an additional factor as well, which perhaps is part and parcel of the factor of Seder, but is an additional factor. The concept of a infrastructure, the concept of a frame of reference, the concept of parameters, the fact that there has to be some type of misgeret, there has to be some type of framework. A person can't live in a vacuum. A person has to live in some type of framework. And it seems that they're an integral part of Kiyama Torah, Limudat Torah, anything to do with Torah, is dependent upon this concept of being within a certain framework. There's a very famous Chazal, we all know it, it's quoted the whole time, it's Rashi Ala Torah that brings it, that prior to Matan Torah, Vayichin Shem Yisrael Neged Aho, Rashi brings the Chazal on the Mechilta, Ki'ish Echad, Belev Echad, right? They were united. But it's a continuation that Rashi brings from the Mechilta, which we tend to ignore. And the continuation is the following. Chazal say Ad kan, until it came to Matan Torah, hayu noisim b'machlokes, v'chaynin b'machlokes. Every time they traveled, there was conflict between the different tribes. You're taking my place, you're taking my space, you're intruding on my space. I should be in front, you should be behind. You should be in front, I should be behind. You should be at the side, I should be on the other side. Constantly the traveling and the encamping involved machlokes. The minute that they got to Maimed HaSinai, because the machlokes disappeared and they were all of them ba'achdus, therefore they were re'uyim lekabalas ha'Torah, say Chazal. Therefore they became re'uyim lekabalas ha'Torah. Why? What's the connection? So Pashtus, the pshat is that when the Torah describes itself, when the Torah describes the lifestyle of Torah, the anhoga of Torah, the way in which a person should live within the boundaries of Torah, the way that Shlomo HaMelech describes it in Mishlei is Drachei Dachei Noyam, the drachim of Torah, the ways of Torah are pleasant. The kol nesivei seho, and all the paths of Torah, shalom, are peaceful. Shalom, the word shalom, comes from the concept of shleimus, of completion. What does shleimus mean? You've got everything you need. Something which has everything that it requires is considered to be a shalom. Something which doesn't go out of its boundaries is considered to be shalom. What's the definition of machlokes? Machlokes is the outcome of encroaching upon somebody else's territory. Where does machlokes usually start? You want to go into somebody else's territory. It doesn't have to be literally, it doesn't have to be physically, but you want to intrude in what the other person sees as being his territory, as seeing as being his, and he doesn't want to let you go in. So you get annoyed. So you end up with a machlokes. Therefore, because Torah is kol nesivei seho shalom, because Torah is shleimus, Torah is the concept of having everything that you want, therefore you can't have a situation of kabbalas ha-Torah when there's machlokes. Therefore, in order that Klal Yisrael should be mekabel Torah, they had to be in a matzav of shalom. How do you get into a matzav of shalom? How do you get into a matzav of shleimus? When you have a misgeret. When you have a framework and you remain within that framework. If everybody knows their place, if everybody has their plays their role within the framework, then you don't have friction. You don't have one guy encroaching upon the other guy. We find, again, something which everybody knows. There's a parsha in the Torah of the army that's going out to war, and the soldier captures a shiksa, and he wants to marry the shiksa. Yifasteya, right? Famous parasha in the Torah, the parasha of Yifasteya. It's true there's a machlokes rishonim as to what type of war are we talking about in reference to the Yifasteya. Are we talking about a melchemes mitzvah? Are we talking about a melchemes rishus? The difference being that in melchemes mitzvah, everybody went to war. Whereas in a melchemes rishus, it was a chosen group of people. The shitta of Rashi, b'shem the Sifri, as opposed to the Rambam and the Ramban, but the Shita of Rashi ala Torah, in the name of the Sifri, is that we're talking about a Melchemes Rishus, where only selected people were allowed to go out to war. And that's when the Parsha of Yifasteya came into play. And who were these selected people that were going out to war? Again, everybody knows the famous Chazal. Everybody knows the Mishnah in Sefer, right, that anybody who was a Dvar Avera got sent back, right, Ish HaYorei. Anybody who's fearful, says the Pasuk, is told, go back home, we don't want you. Say Chazal, what does fearful mean? Yorei Minu Avera, somebody who's scared that he did an Avera. Say Chazal, what sort of Avera did he do? Says the Gemara, even if he was over an Aveir Drabonon, he spoke between putting on his Tefillin Shel Yad and his Tefillin Shel Rosh, which is an Aveir Drabonon, He wasn't allowed to go to war. He went home. Which gives us an inkling and gives us some sort of idea of the spiritual caliber of these people who went out to war. Right? So you imagine what this army looked like. It was a bunch of Rav Chaim Kanievskis. That's what it was. Right? With their walking sticks. Right? Off they went to war. And they capture a non-Jewish woman. And this guy who didn't even have an Averid Rabbanon, he was never an Averid Rabbanon, gets up and he says, I can't, I've got to marry the Shiksa. What happened all of a sudden? We find another very strange thing. It says, Legabe Melchemes Midyon, that they captured spoils of war. They came back with a fortune. The Midianites were wealthy. And they captured animals, and they captured silver, and they captured gold. Armies capture in a war. So the Torah tells us that in every war, you've got the people who do the actual fighting, and then you've got what the Israelis call the jobniks, right? The people who are not fighting, but they're there, they're the backup, right? You need the cooks, the people who are in charge of supplies, the people who are bringing the water, right? The people who stay in the background, but they're also involved. Say the Psukim that when the soldiers are going to fight, bring back the spoils of war, they have to divide it with the backup teams. Goes half-half. But, says the Pasuk, each one from their half has to give a tax to the Ribbono Shel Olam, to Hekdesh. The tax differs between the people who went to war, who actually fought, and the people who were in the background. The actual fighters only had to give 1/5 of 1% of what they got. Whereas the people who were in the background, who didn't do the actual fighting but were the backup, they have to give 2% of what they get from the spoils of war. And they have to give this to Eliezer HaKohen. In other words, the ones who fight, they give their 1/5% to Eliezer HaKohen, and the backup people have to give their 2% to the Levim, who did the work in the Mishkan. To which the Mefarshim say, what was the point of this tax, which is described as being in the Torah as Meches Lashem, a tax to the Ribbono Shel Olam? Bechorah Pshat, to answer both these questions, is the same. War brings out the negativity in a person. War brings out the worst in people. The Haraya, you guys are too old to remember. Too young to remember. But there haven't been many wars around since you guys have been around, other than certain, you know, skirmishes in Afghanistan and various other places, which, to glorify the Marines, they like to call war. But real wars there haven't been. But immediately after the Vietnam War, or in the 12 years after the Vietnam War, there were a whole series of scandals and court cases of the most unbelievable atrocities that American soldiers did during the course of the war. And the interesting thing is that these soldiers were taken to court eventually. They were court-martialed. You know, these weren't, you know, some redneck or some hick, right? Or some Afro-American, to be politically correct. Or some Hispanic, to be politically correct. These were people who in civilian life were doctors, lawyers, right? These were the cream of American society. What happened? Because that's the nature of war. The nature of war is that it brings out the worst in people. Why does war bring out the worst in people? Because in everyday life, we live within a certain framework. And the framework is a combination of various things. But there's a certain framework, and when you're in a certain framework, you're controlled by the framework. War, by definition, is the breaking of a framework. What's totally unacceptable in everyday life suddenly becomes acceptable in war. It's an amazing thing when you think about it. If a guy takes a submachine gun, right, goes out on Fifth Avenue and starts shooting people, right, he makes the headlines, right, and in the daily news you get a 7-inch headline, you know, massacre and atrocity takes place in the middle of Manhattan. Put a uniform on the guy, send him somewhere else, he does the same thing, he comes back a hero, he gets a medal. Why? Because that's what war is all about. War is the breaking of normalcy, of the framework which a person lives within, acts within, and behaves within. Therefore, you can't come along with a question. This is a guy who in normal life wouldn't even be Eilal Daita to be over in Yisrael Rabbanan. How come when it comes to war, right, he's falling for a shiksa? The answer is because that's the nature of war. It breaks down the misgeret. It breaks down the framework. And therefore you need, immediately after a war, some type of antidote to the breakdown of the misgeret. What is the antidote to the breakdown of the misgeret? The antidote to the breakdown of the misgeret is Mechas Lashem. Do something for the Ribbono Shel Olam. Do something spiritual. Get back into spirituality. We find that the parsha of Shaftim comes after the last pasuk in Parshas Re'eh, and the Mefarshim asked the question, what's the connection between Shaftim and Shaftim? Titin Lecha on the last pasuk of Re'eh, Ish kemat nasiyo de kibirchus Hashem aleikim asher nasa mecha. And Chazal say, Rambam brings it halacha lemaisa, that when Yontif came, Beis Din had to make special police force that went around the parks and the places of leisure to make sure that the tznius was kept and that the men and the women weren't hanging around together there. Why? Because Yontif broke the regular day-to-day framework. Everybody came up to Yerushalayim. People weren't in their normal setting. When people are not in their normal setting, when they're not in their framework, when they're not in the everyday framework that they normally have, trouble starts. Why? Because when you're in your everyday framework, you haven't got too much time to do aveiros. You're tied up. There was a bachur in yeshiva who woke up one morning, gates of yeshiva, woke up one morning and he decided he's going to become a chassid. And he became a chassid. And he joined a particular chassidus which wasn't very popular. And his friends went running to the Rosh Yeshiva of Leigh Gurwitz and they said, he's become a chassid, what do we do? And Leigh Gurwitz said, very good. And they said, what do you mean, Rabbi? You're the guy who's, you know, sort of like, always fighting against this group of chassidim. Why? He said, look, this guy is not the great learner, right? So he's wasted his time. If he wastes his time, you've got to do aveiros. He said, become a chassid. He said, just think for a moment. He gets up in the morning, he's got to go to the mikveh. So it takes an hour. Go to the mikveh, come back to the mikveh, find your towel, not find your towel. Then he's got to daven, right? Because the chassid davens. He may not learn, but he davens, right? Then he's finishing davening, he's got to say his chitas and his chumish and his tilim and his tanya. There's another hour gone by. Then he's got to eat breakfast. Eat breakfast, he's got to be notly daven. He's a chassid, notly daven, he's got to find his record and put on his record, he's got to find his hat and put on his hat, right? Then he's got to find a towel to wipe the keli for Natilis Yadayim. He's got to throw the towel over his shoulder and hold the keli with the towel when he does the Natilis Yadayim. Then he's got to sit down, but he's a chassid, he's got to make everything from the siddur. He's got to make them from the siddur. Then he's got a bench, right? He says, wait. By the time he's benched, he's got to find his Mayim Acharonim until he goes to the Gen, find his Talagan, swing it over his shoulder, there's Mayim Acharonim, go back, oh, find his hat, get his jacket. He says, it's lunchtime. Lunchtime, he's got to wash again, he's hungry, it's lunchtime. He says the same thing, then it's Mincha. Then he's going to say Tilin, to Chachasid. He says, by the time he's finished, he's got the time to Averis, very good, let him be a Chassid. When you do Averis, when you got nothing to do, if you're busy the whole time, the minig by Chassidei sons was that they did not eat Malav Malka. They never ate Malav Malka. The minig of the sons was not to eat Malav Malka. Why didn't they eat Malav Malka? In sons, there's a whole reasons that lie behind it. I can't say that all the reasons are very, you know, halachic, but there are Chassidish reasons behind the fact why they didn't eat Malav Malka. The exception to the rule of sons not eating Malav Malka, right, the skion of sons, right, the Einikul of sons who did eat Malav Malka was Rav Shlomo Bobova. The Bobova Rebbe of Shlomo, he used to eat Malav Malka. And it created a big stir. Einikul of Divrei Chaim, he ate Malav Malka, Divrei Chaim never ate Malav Malka. So he once told over his story, he said, I'll tell you why I eat Malav Malka. He said, in World War II, when he was running away from the Germans, he said he was hiding in a bunker. This bunker was built underneath a house. There was a wealthy man who had a house and he built this bunker underneath it. And the entrance was in the kitchen, and it was the floor, which there was a false door there. And in this bunker, which was meant to hold about 9 people, there were 30-something people, including women and children. And they spent months in this bunker. They used to go out at night to find food, to wash a bit, to this and that. There were goyim who lived in the house next door, who were cheshish that there were Jews in this bunker, and they went and they told the Germans. But the goyim didn't know how to get into the bunker. They just knew there was a bunker. They just had a chashash that there was a bunker there because they saw people sort of like wandering around at night. They shouldn't have been there. And Rav Shlomo Bobova said that one day they were in this bunker and they heard German troops in the kitchen, searching for the entrance to the bunker. Of course, everybody got into a panic. And somebody said, one of the women said, let's make a Kabbalah, that if the Rebbeinu Shlomo saves us, that we'll make a Kabbalah upon ourselves something. So people came up with ideas. One said, you know, let's let all the men make a Kabbalah, they'll finish us within a year. The other one said, let's do this and that. And he said, listen, Rabbi Isaac, he said, the nature of the human being is that when he's under pressure, he's willing to make a Kabbalah upon himself over anything. But then he usually takes upon himself something which is impossible in practical life to fulfill afterwards. Yeah, let's be Mekabbalah something. But let's be Mekabbalah something that everybody can do. Not something which is too big. But let's be Mekabbalah upon ourselves that we'll eat Malav Malka. We'll wash and we'll eat the Kazayas and Malav Malka. Everybody was Mekabbalah upon himself, the Germans disappeared. So he said, that's why I eat Malav Malka. Personal thing because of this Kabbalah that I made at the time. But the Yesod is a Meridiki Yesod. The Yesod is that when you make a Kabbalah, you've got to be very careful. It's got to be a Kabbalah that you can stick with, you can keep with, you can do. Everybody knows the Shalah. Shalah HaKadosh says that Shavuos is a Yom HaDin. Shavuos is no different than Rosh Hashanah. Shavuos is exactly the same as Rosh Hashanah, Yom HaDin. The only difference is that there are different Yemei Din during the year which are applicable to different things. Shavuos is Yom HaDin Olim Teira and Bittul Teira. Shavuos, every single Jew stands in judgment before the Ribbono Shlelem on how much he learned Teira, how much he was Mevatel Teira, and what Siyata Dishmai he's going to get for the following year in reference to Olim Teira. And everybody knows that when you're standing before Yom HaDin, 4 days before Yom HaDin, 5 days before Yom HaDin, everybody's looking for things to do, to Kabbalahs to take upon themselves in order to be Zeich HaBedin. One can safely assume that everybody sitting here are here because they want to be Laim Dei Teira. But each and every one of us has his problems. And it's common, and it's common to all of us. Right? There are no exceptions. Everybody's got problems with learning. But it's before Yom HaDin, and before Yom HaDin, if you make a Kabbalah, the Rebbeinu Shlom comes towards you. But you can't make a Kabbalah which is not a practical one. It has to be a Kabbalah which is feasible. So first of all, we see the importance of a mezgeret, the importance of a framework. If there is a framework, if the yeshiva supplies a framework of Seder Rishon, a Seder Sheni, a Seder Shlishi, a Shachris, a Mincha, a Ma'ariv, at least the next few days, it's not too difficult to make a Kabbalah for 5 days that will stick taka to the Shachris, the Mincha, and the Ma'ariv, and the Sdorim, we'll learn taka the full Sdorim. It's not something which is out of whack. But perhaps something else as well. There's a moshe which I like saying over, there's an American moshe which I've said it over a number of times in different situations, from which the Chofetz Chaim used to say. And it's a gewaldike moshe. The Chofetz Chaim used to tell the following story. He said there was a village in Eastern Europe. And it was a village like all the Eastern European villages. A few hundred Jews. Every village had its absolute, total, complete and utter pauper, right? The guy who didn't have 2 cents to rub together. And every village had the gevir, right? Had the guy who had money. And in this village as well, there was a famous gevir in this village, very wealthy man called Reb Baruch. But he knew him. He was the philanthropist of the village, he was the guy who had money. And he was stuck, and he was a bochesed, and he was a good person. There was also the guy who was known in the, didn't have anything at all, the Oni of the village, Zalman had a huge family, all daughters, and he didn't have any parnasa. Vayayayim, he's got to marry off his oldest daughter. Kitzel starts suggesting shidduchim, he sees that he needs 500 rubles to marry off this daughter. 500 rubles was a lot of money in those days. Otherwise, nobody's willing to listen even to a shidduch. If he's not willing to give an adunya of 500 rubles, there's nothing to talk about. Where's he going to get 500 rubles from? So he says to himself, you know what? There's a gevir in the village. Nice guy, baruch, big baruch chesed. I'm going to ask him for a loan for 500 rubles. When I have the money, I'll pay him back. The kids are... He goes over to the telephone and he picks up a phone to Reb Baruch. Reb Baruch answers the phone and he says to him, Reb Baruch, yeah. He says, good morning. It's Zalman speaking. How are you? What's news? How do you feel? How's business? How are your kids doing? Because Reb Baruch's listening to this and he knows who already is there. He knows that this is a guy who wants something from him, but he can't get to the point because he's embarrassed. So he says to him, you know what, Reb Zalman, let's go straight to the point. How can I help you?